How many of you, just by chance, I'm Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, and this is the kind of third piece in a series this week dealing with how Christians in other parts of the world are challenging our faith. And just by chance, for how many of you is this the first time that you've been to a session that I've done? I kind of thought that might be the case. Because a lot of the staff have been coming to my sessions, and they're in staff meetings, so we won't have any of those people. Well, let me try to create a little bit of a context for what I want to do tonight, particularly for those of you who haven't been attending any of my sessions. I have, over the past 18 or 20 years, been working on issues of hunger and the political and economic causes of hunger and how those relate or connect to us as people of faith. I would just ask you to keep in mind that somewhere around 40 million people die each year from hunger or hunger-related causes, which is the equivalent of 300 jumbo jet aircraft crashing every day, filled to capacity, crashing every day for a year. And I would ask you to think about if that in fact were to happen, there would be all kinds of people raising fundamental questions about airplane construction and air traffic controller systems. We'd be asking all of the why causal questions, but we rarely do that when it comes to this issue of hunger, which is really an issue of inequality and power relationships and oppression from my point of view. What I've been focusing on over the last week and a half, and I leave tomorrow, is my wife and I, we have been living and working in Central America and regular visitors there over the last 8 or 9 years. And out of our experiences of living there, and seeing firsthand the incredible human carnage, direct consequence of U.S. policy, I have attempted to get inside of that policy and to unmask it. And the bookstore always wants you to do this, so I'll just mention it. I did that in a book called War Against the Poor. And it's my belief that what the U.S. has done over the last number of years and is even more likely to do now, given the thaw in the relationships between East-West, is that the United States has increasingly been defining its enemies as the organized poor in third world, or what I call the two-thirds world. And I have, over the last week and a half, tried to make a case for that, including lots of quotations from U.S. government leaders, including one I'll just mention now from General Maxwell Taylor, who said, as the leading have nation, the United States must prepare itself to fight wars against have-not peoples in order to protect our national valuables. Well, that's all just a brief little bit of background, because I have a feeling that my starting point tonight, which is going to be a quotation from the Latin American Council of Churches, which is addressed to us as Christians living in the United States, will be incomprehensible to some of us, because we're not used to viewing, many of us at least, are not used to viewing the United States as a source of backing governments that aren't seeking freedom for the people, but in fact are seeking privileges. And I would say that is generally the case in Central and Latin America, as well as the Philippines and a number of other places. So that's meant just to create a little bit of a background, realizing that there are probably already points of conflicts with some of you in terms of how we would view U.S. policy. Nonetheless, this is a quotation from the Latin American Council of Churches that followed the invasion of Panama. And this letter that was sent came about a month after another very strong letter was sent after the murder of the Jesuit priests, in which the Latin American Council of Churches asked the question to U.S. Christians, how long are you going to tolerate your government spending $1 million a day when that government that we're funding is killing priests, obstructing the work of the churches, making the work of the churches basically impossible. So that letter was sent, and then within a little over a month, the invasion of Panama took place, which was followed up by another urgent appeal to you, to Christians living in the United States. And it, a part of it reads as follows. It says, "Now with Panama invaded, we Latin American Christians feel indignant when we hear the count on North American victims of the operation that was planned with evil intentions and hypocrisy, and yet nothing is said about the hundreds or thousands of Afro-Indo-Latin American lives destroyed physically and psychologically by such an abominable adventure, which is a repetition of past crimes in Santo Domingo, Grenada, Guatemala, Nicaragua, El Salvador, in an endless list. We ask ourselves then, how long will Christian churches in the U.S. continue to tolerate, and in some cases even justify, these actions that not only violate the most basic human rights, but also the right that the weakest or smallest countries have to make their own decisions and to write their own history?" So that's just a brief description of one letter. Earlier in the week, I did a session on, along with Molefe from South Africa, on the Kairos documents. And in Central America, in South Africa, and more recently, Christians gathering from about 7 different countries in third world settings have gathered together, and they've named this time a Kairos time. And Kairos is simply a Greek word that means moment of truth. It means time, but it means decisive time. That somehow that God is working in this moment, calling us to new creative forms of living out our faith. And that if we miss that opportunity, there are likely to be very disastrous consequences. That's part of what leads to the question of how are third world or two-thirds world Christians calling us to conversion, and why. Okay, with that background, what I have in mind for tonight is really a lot of participatory discussion from you, and this room doesn't lend itself very well to that, so we're going to have to work at that a little bit. But what I'd like to suggest when I tell you to break into small groups is just try to quickly find someone that you don't know. And just one other person or maybe two other people. So the group's no bigger than 3, so everyone has an opportunity to talk about the questions that I'm going to pose. And I don't have any kind of blueprint that flows out of this. What I do have is a series of questions that I think it's very important for us to ask ourselves as Christians living in this country in this time. The first question I'd like you to deal with in groups of 2 or 3, and we'll do this in short blocks of time and then report back some of your insights, is I want to pose for you the idea that certainly comes across in the Kairos documents that I named earlier. And as a student of theology, I would say that the basic religious problem that the Bible poses throughout is not the problem of belief versus unbelief. It's not the problem of believing in God versus atheism. The problem that the Bible poses is that of idolatry, the worshiping and following of false gods. So the question that I want to pose to you, and again, ask you to break up into groups and just spend probably just 3 or 4 minutes on this, and then we're going to report back. And I have about 4 or 5 of these, and I'm going to want to get your input on briefly. But I want you to ask yourself, what are our modern-day idols? What are idols within our context, within our country, within our churches? When we hear the term idols, most of us, I think, have an Old Testament image of a little figurine or something that people worshipped rather than God. But that's not the nature of idolatry that the biblical writers generally talk about. And I want you to think about in part in the context that I presented of what Latin American Council of Churches is saying to us and lots of other third world Christians, are challenging our faith. They're saying that somehow their economic oppression, and those of you who saw the film Romero and attended the discussion that I led on why is it that U.S.-backed governments kill priests, that their economic oppression and their religious persecution, third world Christians are saying to us, is somehow connected to our lack of faithfulness, to our idolatry, as it were. So the first question, break into small groups for about 3 or 4 minutes, is simply to ask and talk about what are the idols of our time? And then we'll come back. Okay, let's pull back together, and you can basically stay where you are because I'm going to have you get into small groups again, and you can just gather in the same small groups. But what I try to do in the interest of time here, as we try to learn from each other, is do this more in a brainstorm rather than debate format. Let's just throw out what kinds of ideas emerged out of your conversation. What are the modern day idols? America. Ourselves. Security, did I hear? Status. Materialism. Military. Power. Health. Uninvolvement. He says he read my book, Empire. A word that most of us don't like to use. He says idols require sacrifices, which is, if you have read, I'm going to call attention to this. This is one of the three Kairos statements that have come out in the last several years. This one's called The Road to Damascus, and they talk openly about how idols need sacrifices. And if your idol is materialism, or Archbishop Romero said that the two main idols that were responsible for the persecution of the church in the context of El Salvador and elsewhere were the idolatry of the national security state and the idol of money, the imperialism of money, they called it. Any others that came up? I mean, I think the really important thing to note and to take very seriously is that it should not surprise us that there are struggles over how the meaning of faith, and that those struggles over the meaning of faith have real life and death consequences, because the biblical story is itself a story of a God that is trying to emerge within a people, a God committed to justice and liberation that oftentimes gets distorted due to idolatry. And idolatry, again, is not something that gets confined to Old Testament or New Testament times. I wanted to just read to you two very brief paragraphs from this document, The Road to Damascus. For people who are interested in these Kairos documents that I've made mention of, if you go over to the Resource Center in Koinonia, you can ask where it is, it's very easy to find, on the first floor in Koinonia, there are copies of these documents if you want to take a look. If you want to look on the bulletin board, you'll also see that there's a letter that ends up having my name on it. And if you're interested in being in touch with a process within the United States of trying to take these documents seriously and trying to discern some sense of our own moment of crisis or opportunity of faith, you can send me a self-addressed stamped envelope and I'll send you some materials. But two paragraphs from this very powerful challenge to faith called The Road to Damascus, which of course is a reference to Paul, or rather Saul, who was persecuting the church and being converted and understanding what he was doing, and then a change obviously in the course of his life. It says, "We have often been silent instead of denouncing injustice and oppression. Instead of working for justice and liberation, we have often remained uninvolved." I think that's probably fairly descriptive of many of us. "How shall we explain this silence and uninvolvement, this blindness and unbelief? For some of us, the reason lies in a life that is not confronted by the suffering and struggle of the poor, and therefore the choice of a convenient God who does not challenge us to take part in a movement for change. I'm just going to stop here and put in parentheses, and this is maybe not a fair statement because I came in late and because I was dealing with a 2.5-month-old and a 2.5-year-old at the time, but I came into your session late last night, Molefe. I haven't talked to you about this. I have no idea how you felt. But part of what I felt was some of the questions that I heard just seemed like there was a chasm between your experience of faith in the midst of struggle and the transformation of that faith and a new understanding of spirituality that was emerging and the kind of questions that we were able to ask. I think that was very revealing to me and is captured in this statement. It's not a judgmental statement necessarily, it's just saying to us that unless we somehow get our lives more involved and in the midst of this, we may miss the kairos. We may miss an opportunity to experience and understand and grow in that kind of faith. Continuing now after that parenthesis, it says, for others, however, the reason for the silence lies in a choice of privilege and power, and a conscious defense of the status quo. In many cases, it includes taking part in attacks against movements for change, in repression, and the killing of the poor. The sin of idolatry lies at the heart of the imperialism of money. In choosing to serve the idols of death rather than the God of life, Christianity is used as a weapon against the people. Very, for me, very, very powerful words. And one of the implications of that for me is that I suspect that many of us kind of know that things aren't going right. And yet, it's very difficult, either because we lack hope or vision or courage, it's very difficult for us to find ways of orienting our lives in a new direction in relation to this spirit that's calling. Okay, the next thing I wanted you to do in a small group was to think briefly about the meaning of a couple of biblical passages, and I'll just mention them to you. The first is at the end of the Beatitudes in Matthew. Reference is Matthew 5, verse 13, and this will be very familiar to you. We've all heard it many times. Just a second here. Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trodden underfoot." You are the salt of the earth. Jesus is speaking to the people of faith. You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored if it is no longer good for anything? My question to you is, what does it mean as people of faith that we're to be the salt of the earth? Another passage that would have a similar kind of meaning that might help you reflect on that question of what it might mean is the notion that we are to be leaven, and as leaven we are somehow instrumental in making the bread rise. But if the leaven isn't working, if it's old, if it's dead, then the bread won't rise. So I want you to play with that image a little bit and talk about what is the significance to say that we are the salt of the earth. And I want you to think about, have we lost our saltiness? And if so, it's said that we're worthless. But what does that image mean, that we are to be the salt of the earth, or that we're to be leaven? So that's the first question. The second question, I will just summarize quickly two biblical stories or passages, and then I want to follow it up with a question. You may remember that Jesus in Luke is out in the wilderness and experiences 40 days and 40 nights of temptation. This, I would say, is an example of Jesus attempting to discern what is the will of God for my life. Jesus is trying to discern what is the nature of his ministry. What does it mean for him to be faithful in the context in which he is living? It's a struggle, and Jesus has all kinds of things competing. Well, in Luke, the way it's laid out in Luke, Jesus comes down from that temptation narrative and from the desert, or the wilderness rather, and he gives his first sermon in which he outlines the nature of his ministry. Do you remember what that sermon is? What it says? That's where Jesus is in the synagogue and he opens the book, and it's to the passage, I believe, in Isaiah that says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to preach good news to the poor, freedom to the captives, liberation to the oppressed, and to announce the acceptable year of the Lord," which most biblical scholars agree is a reference to the Jubilee. Jesus was announcing a land reform to a people who had experienced tremendous suffering because of their landlessness. Because without land, what ended up happening is if you got in debt, you sold your family into slavery. Now, second passage that I just wanted to briefly summarize is one, again, that you'll all be familiar with. A rich young man, or in one of the Gospels it says a rich young ruler, goes to Jesus and says, "What do I have to do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus tells him a few things, and the man kind of responds a little bit self-righteously, like, "Well, I've done most of those things." And Jesus says, "Well, you've got one more thing to do. Go sell what you have, give it to the poor, and come follow me." And the man goes away very sorrowful. And then Jesus uses that as an example of how you can't serve God and mammon. You can't serve God and riches. Now, my second question, I'll probably have to repeat the first one because I've gone on so long, but my question for you related to those two passages is, what is the good news in that for us? How do we hear those passages where Jesus announces the fundamental nature of his ministry after all this time in the wilderness being tempted, comes down and announces his ministry in terms of freedom to the captives, liberation to the poor, announcing a land reform which challenges the powerful? What's the good news in that for us? How does that come to us as good news? Or when the rich young ruler comes to Jesus and says, "What do I have to do?" And Jesus says, "Go sell and come follow me." And that rich one goes away, and Jesus uses that as an example of how you can't serve God and mammon. In what ways is that good news for us? Okay, and again, the first question is, what does it mean that we're to be the salt of the earth? Okay, I'll give you a little bit more time on that in this one. I'll give you about 10 minutes. Okay, I hate to break this up, but I think I'll ask to pull you back together again. So again, very briefly, in a brainstorm format, I'd just like you to throw out some insights that were gained. What does it mean to say that we're the salt of the earth? What is at stake there? We should what? We should all get pickled? Is that what you said? If I would have heard it, I wouldn't have repeated it, but I thought, no, that can't be what it. Okay, we're called to action. We're called to be a movement of people. If we don't do it, nobody else will. What else? Okay, we're called to preserve the integrity of the message and not be bland, wishy-washy. Okay, so we shouldn't be silent. We should be raising the questions that need to be raised. Prophetic voice. Okay, salt does not only preserve, it also burns out the dirt within us. Go ahead. So it adds vibrancy, intensity to life. Jesus raising the question about, do you have to be careful? I just remember the Commissioner of Agriculture in Texas. Any of you from Texas? There's one. Jim Hightower says, the only thing you find in the middle of the road are dead skunks and armadillos. So I think that's a good lesson for us to think about when we're tempted to be in the to stay in the middle and somehow say, well, then we won't be too salty and we won't be. So anyway, you didn't like that. I guess they're not from Texas. What can I say? Okay. How about the other? Well, just one comment about that. It seems to me that when we're talking about that we are called to be the salt of the earth, again, the question it poses is the question of our identity. our ultimate allegiance of who we are, who we belong to, what shapes who we are. And the danger of losing the salt and becoming worthless is that our faith gets distorted. And then in this country, again, when we name those idols, materialism, I would say nationalism and patriotism have become idols that usurp our faith. And that makes the salt bland and it makes it worthless. We become worthless in this society when we don't maintain the integrity of our faith. And we do that, I think, only through involvement. Okay, how about the other question, which is one that should be, I think, a very important question to people, most of us in this room. How do we hear those messages as good news? Because we always talk about the good news, but the good news can be full of pain and promise. Okay, so it's telling us, reminding us, that wealth, power, and privilege of all forms is not what we need to live by. What else? I'll summarize that very briefly, and tell me if this is fair, if it captures the essence of what you said at least, is that part of, if we take this message seriously, is it would help us deal with the fact that there is so much alienation and emptiness in this culture, and that these passages remind us of that there are lots of empty dead-end promises there, and that what you've experienced in living overseas is that in the midst of a lot less material goods and things, that there is in that struggle, there is something very powerful. Okay, anybody else? What is good news? Okay, he says, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. I remember as a seminary student years and years and years ago, taking a test, and it was dealing with the book of Amos. And if you read the book of Amos, which is, I think, maybe the most important book for reasonably comfortable North Americans to read, they at the end of Amos, apparently most biblical, again, scholars say, they added on a few comforting verses. And the question in my exam was, if you take those away, which were added by a later writer, is there any hope in Amos? And my response was, yes, because there is no hope without honesty. There is no hope without us honestly confronting the situations in which we live. And again, in the context, I'll be going over miles of material that most of you weren't here for. But for me, unless we get honest about the nature of what's happening to our own democracy and the nature of what covert activities do to our democratic system and what the kind of funding of governments of El Salvador are doing to people in El Salvador, there isn't any hope that we're going to come out of that. If we try to shield, if we go to the football game instead, if we do whatever we do to keep these ideas away from us and our children, that's not hopeful. So honesty is in itself something that's essential to truth and to new possibilities. Okay, in the interest of time, I want to move us on. You can continue thinking about those. I want to do one more small group activity, and I want to share with you two quotations from two of my favorite people. One is from Archbishop Romero, and again, some of you saw the film Romero. Romero had this to say, just a couple sentences, about the mission of the church. And I want you to think about this in the context of the churches of which you are a part or have been. Romero says, "This is the mission entrusted to the church. A hard mission, to uproot sins from history, to uproot sins from the political order, to uproot sins from the economy, to uproot sins from wherever they are. What a hard task. It has to meet conflicts amid so much selfishness, so much pride, so much vanity, so many who have enthroned the reign of sin among us." And the second quotation that maybe a couple of you heard from me earlier in the week, from John Sobrino. John Sobrino is a Jesuit priest who I know from El Salvador. He was not murdered in El Salvador in November because he happened to be outside the country. The people that he lived with, the murder of the Jesuits took place at the residence where John Sobrino lives. And he had this to say in a recent interview with Sojourners magazine. He says, "You cannot be a believer in God today in this world if you do not take oppression seriously. What is at stake here is faith and humanity. I don't know how you can be a human being on this planet today if this growing oppression and poverty is not your central issue." Now, those two quotes, one from Romero, one from Sobrino, lay out a challenge to us as people of faith and a challenge for us, those of us who are part of the church. And the questions I want to ask you are these, or to have you ask in your small groups. What needs to happen in our churches to take seriously those visions of the church that I just read? In other words, what do we have to do in our churches in order to take oppression and poverty seriously, overcoming it? What do we have to do in our churches to make the mission of the church more to uproot not just our personal sins, but to uproot the structural sins that we are all connected to? What would specific steps that we could take be? What would be the likely consequences if we were to take them? And what are some of the obstacles and signs of hope that we see? Okay, so obstacles and signs of hope. What would be the likely consequences? What are some of the specific steps? Again, in a nutshell, the question I'm asking is, if, in fact, this is a time in which God's Spirit is calling us, in which our two-thirds world brothers and sisters are calling us to conversion, part of what they're challenging us to do is to be the authentic church for our time. And they're saying that that means to take overcoming oppression much, much more seriously. How do we do that? What does that mean in the life of our churches? What does it mean for each of us? And I'll give you about 7 minutes, and then I'll give us a couple minutes to learn from each other. Are the questions too easy? Would you like some harder? So again, quickly, in terms of what emerged out of your conversations, what needs to happen? What needs to happen? What specifics can we do? Okay, so it takes a real commitment to learning the truth. I would say that that's very, very important. Obviously, studying and studying and studying and studying can be a way out, but we need access to alternative forms of information. We need to acknowledge it's going to take some work, I think, to unlearn much of what we've learned. What else? We need more kind of personal relationships and sharing. I would just lift up one sign of hope in addition to having the people we have in the village who are sharing their stories in ways that hopefully have power for us. I think one of the most hopeful signs for me within the Lutheran Church has been the connection with Lutherans in this country, to some degree with the struggle in Namibia and also to the church in El Salvador. That because of that connection, we've taken a little bit more seriously when we talk about the body of Christ being one body with many members, and when one member celebrates, we should celebrate, and when one member suffers, we should suffer with them. And with that in mind, just on your way out, if you haven't done it, I would encourage you to, with the recent death threats again to Medardo Gomez, the Lutheran bishop in El Salvador, please write. There's all the information you need. There's the addresses that you need. All you have to do is write a letter, put it in the basket, and leave some postage behind. What else came up?
Maybe another
Okay, you know, for years and years and years, we thought of ourselves as we're going to take the gospel to these poor people. And what we're recognizing is that, in fact, we are being called to new levels of faithfulness. And so we need to encourage our own conversion through contact with our brothers and sisters who are living out their faith in the midst of struggle. Good. What else? Okay, so we need to not abandon the children, in fact, to really focus on children. Just as a plug, and this will be, again, a very for those of you who hate participatory sessions, you may not want to come to another one, but Holden really encourages that kind of conversation. But tomorrow my wife and I are going to be doing a session at 10:45 on, you know, how do we deal with global justice issues in the context of family choices, and that's a way of trying to involve children as well in these concerns. What else? Yeah. So you've really touched on, again, two, I think, very important things. Another thing that we can do is to encourage our congregations to be involved in sanctuary of refugees, or there are other ways of doing that. There's an overground railroad of ways of working with refugees, having them tell their stories in the community, sharing our homes, and in this case, these refugees or people in sanctuary organized a march to commemorate Romero that involved lots and lots of children. Yes? Okay, she's saying that another thing that we need is more analysis, and I would say, yes, that's true, but I would say we need to be very careful too, because again, one of the things that our brothers and sisters are telling us, and that we're really, really good at this, is that I'm not going to take any action until I'm really certain that I've got this right. And meanwhile, what they're telling us is we are acting. But analysis is very important. And I would lay that out as I think what we need if we're going to renovate the church in this country is we need people who are going to take risks within their congregations. We need the formation of small groups similar to what we see taking shape in other areas of the world, where analysis, Bible study, and action become an ongoing process among committed Christians who really can take risks together because they are in community with each other. One of the big problems that we need to overcome, I believe, in this country is our isolation and our sense of individualism that we don't work very well. Now, I'm going to officially end this because we're over on the tape ministry, and then I'll take one or two more comments, but we are over. Anybody can. So you're saying we need to be 11, but that 11 needs to take us to the streets, and in that way it will probably be a leavening factor within the churches, but we shouldn't get too caught up in just bureaucratic entanglements. Okay.